At this point, Simon, I think I turn it over to you. We give him a little visibility for a change. Let's give Simon a big round of applause. The man behind the scenes is now in front of the scenes.
Well, thank you, Dave. This is really not about me. This is about something that a lot of our mayors have been asking and trying to get every year, is to get some of our local universities involved in the work that we do. And this is what I'm here to present today, is the two teams of students that are going to present the projects that they've done over the last year. And I want to talk about the NASA DEVELOP program, which we've had a relationship for with several years, and they have a project coming to an end this year that was some wetland mapping in Georgian Bay, and I've seen the presentation. I've had a sneak peek of it, and it's incredible what they can do with the fantastic mapping data that NASA is capable of producing with their satellites and all their fancy equipment. And I'd like then, actually, let's bring all three students up first, and then I'll introduce them. So, if you want to come up, and then I'll finish my introducing you. Sorry about that. See, I'm not used to being in front of this. That's not me. That's why I always stay behind the scenes. Okay, back to what I was supposed to do, which was bring them up first. the first project is from a collaboration with NASA, and Emily Adams is here to present it to us today. Emily was the project lead on it as she was finishing her master's degree in, biology and at Old Dominion University. And she's here to present this project. Now she's working for NASA after being done with her studies. And then after Emily, we'll have our project that we've been doing in a collaboration with NOAA and the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. And this project named Climate Ready Cities was a collaboration. We have a team of six students, and they've traveled to five of our member cities and did case studies and fact sheets and very informational, infographic information that's easy to consume for everybody. And they'll be talking about some of the parts of the project that they've been doing. Some of you saw this team last year in Thunder Bay was trying to get to know some of our membership, and they're here to present the results of their project. And we have Alexandra Brewer and Samuel Molnar. And Emily, please take it away with the first project.
Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation to come and allow me to present the work that I led over the fall, last fall and this past spring. So the DEVELOP program falls within the NASA Earth Science Division, and they are responsible for the suite of Earth-observing satellites seen on this slide. And these satellites measure the Earth as an integrated system. And this has been a highly productive year for Earth science, with five satellites launched in the past year and a half and 11 before the end of the decade. So the DEVELOP program itself bridges the gap between these Earth observations and society by partnering with local, state, regional, federal, or international organizations to help solve environmental issues. In doing so, we try to build capacity both in our participants by providing them with workplace development skills, and also in our partner organizations by informing their decision-making processes utilizing NASA Earth observation data. We typically have over 350 participants each year working on over 80 projects all over the world, as seen in this graphic on the right-hand side there. So DEVELOP has a wide variety of projects covering many different types of application areas, including water resources, agriculture, climate change. But at their core, they have four main things in common listed here. They all will address a community concern related to environmental issues. They all collaborate with an organization that will benefit from using those NASA Earth observations, and they will enhance their decision-making process. They utilize and highlight the application of NASA Earth observations, and we also have a team of science advisors and mentors that help us complete our projects. We have 15 locations all over the country and one international location in Nepal, and we work on these projects year-round. So the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities initiative has been very kind to develop, and we've benefited from a very strong partnership with them since 2008. And together, we've completed several projects, some of which are listed here during this time, and the most recent of which was the Great Lakes Climate Project, which was the one that I led. This project, completed in the spring, studied the impact of decreasing lake water levels on the Georgian Bay wetlands. And the idea from this project came about from conversations with Dave Ulrich about the historic low water levels seen in 2013. And from these conversations, we also involved Georgian Bay Forever and David Sweetnam. And this led us to the idea to study the shoreline wetlands extent change for the Georgian Bay. So wetlands exist at the interface of terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. The high water table controls the soil chemistry and development, and they provide important ecosystem services, including improving water quality, serving as groundwater recharge points, as natural carbon sinks, and they help control flood and erosion, and they're also habitats for economically and environmentally important species. So these ecosystem services have been estimated to be worth over $10,000 an acre. And the Great Lakes wetlands have been estimated to decrease more than 50% due to human development, largely for draining and ditching for agriculture. There we go. So I'm sure I don't have to tell this group how important the Great Lakes are, being the largest source of freshwater in the world. But a detailed, consistent, easily updatable wetlands land cover classification for the region is lacking. So that's where this project started off from. And we created one using NASA Earth observations that would allow for wetland extent change to be determined over time. And here we have a water level graph from the Georgian Bay from 1987, which was a historic high water level period, and all the way through 2013, which was an historic low. And you see here the variation, small variations in water level on seasonal or even annual or multi-annual scales aren't typical, and wetlands are adapted to this change. However, the long-term decrease over time could be detrimental to the wetlands. And on this graph, the red line is in-situ gauge data from Parry Sound. And the blue line is OSTM JSON 1 satellite data, so they correlate very well to look at how lake water levels are changing. So the objectives of this project were to create those land cover classification types within a 10-kilometer shoreline buffer, and then use those to create wetland extent change maps. A brief overview of the methodology: we used many sensors in this project, including the Landsat series, which provided us with a scene from 1987 corresponding to the high water level date, and Landsat 8, which corresponded to the low water level date in June of 2013. We used a digital elevation model from the Aster satellite, and we also used water level data from the TOPEX series. There was many things involved in the data processing. I won't go too much into it here, but if you're more interested, I can talk more about that later. And then for the data analysis, that involved selecting ideal sites for different land cover types. So for example, we would go and select an urban area as a training site that then went into our algorithm to determine where all of the urban sites were around the wetlands, or around the Georgian Bay, excuse me, and we repeated that process for every land cover type. And all these were inputs into our script, our algorithm, which calculated and determined all of the different land cover types. And then finally, we compared our maps to the Southern Ontario Land Resource Information System map, which only covers just the southwestern portion of the Georgian Bay. But we kind of did a sanity check there to make sure our results made sense. So here's the first results. The one on the left is July 1987, and the one on the right is June 2013. And the wetlands here are indicated in red. And you already start to see some loss around, particularly around the southern portion of the Georgian Bay. But what we can do is reanalyze the data and create a wetland extent change map comparing the 2 years. And so the yellow area is areas of no change. The blue areas are gain the wetlands, and the red areas are loss of wetlands. So we've really seen a loss of wetlands, particularly around the southern portion of Georgian Bay, but an increase in wetlands around the northern portion of Georgian Bay, which was particularly interesting because in talks with David Sweetnam, when we were presenting this information to him, he mentioned that the fishery stocks, they've seen a drastic decrease in the south and an increase in the north, and they really didn't understand why that was happening until we completed this research. So from that, from these maps, he was able to look further into those fisheries and see with the wetlands change maps and make some decisions regarding the fishery stocks. So one thing that's important also to say about this particular map is while we chose dates representing highest and lowest water levels, there are other land change use changes that could account for wetlands loss, including increases in agriculture and increases in urban development. So this result is not directly correlated with water loss. There are many other factors to consider when looking at this map. So in conclusion, just some numbers for you guys. Between the years of 1987 and 2013, there's a 7% wetland gain, largely in the north, 10.8% wetland loss, which is a 3.8% net loss, which is 430 square kilometers of loss of wetlands. And so the benefits of this research are a more cost-effective, replicable methodology for land cover classification maps over large spatial scales. We not only presented this research, but we also handed off all of our methodology as well as a tutorial guide. So Georgian Bay Forever can either use this to have a different timestamp around the Georgian Bay, or they can use it for a different area. And this will help facilitate the comparison of wetlands over time and also provide insights on the impact of changing water levels for wetlands health. So if you would like to know a little bit more information about the NASA DEVELOP program, we're always looking for more project ideas and partnerships. And good projects just are achievable with NASA Earth Observing data over a 10 to 30 week period. And if you'd like to know more information about that, feel free to come find me. And this is just a picture of it's an astronaut picture from the International Space Station, and I believe that is Sarnia right there. So, it's going to zoom in too. Didn't know that. Yep, there it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Emily. I do not envy our next two speakers who have to trump a picture taken from space, but I think this first example was one, and so will be the University of Michigan's one, of research that can actually lead to positive change, and I think that's what's really important to you mayors and elected officials is trying to find ways to get better information to make your cities better. And in that regard, I would like to invite Alexandra Brewer and Samuel Molnar to talk to us about their Climate Ready Cities project.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for sticking around for day two of the conference. So Sam and I, as Simon said, are here representing a group of graduate students from the University of Michigan. We teamed up with NOAA and the Cities Initiative for about the past year and a half on this Climate Ready Great Lakes Cities project. And it was to promote climate adaptation actions in the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Basin. We wanted to give you a brief overview of our work on the project, but also to go more in depth in some things that maybe aren't stated explicitly in our materials, but we thought were really interesting takeaways from the project. So how many in this room are familiar with adaptation? A lot of hands. That's awesome. When I first kind of took up the adaptation topic about 7 years ago, there wouldn't have been that many hands in this room. But the first question to answer in any sort of talk like this is, why adapt? I will say for our purposes, you know, academics really like to debate the semantics of the terms adaptation, but the way we'll use it, it's synonymous with resilience, preparedness. It's anything that describes an action now taken to improve a system's ability to withstand climate-related shocks in the future. So circling back to this why adapt question, we know that the pace of climate change is already to a point where we will feel impacts. Many cities have already reported they have felt impacts. I quite like this quote from a researcher at the University of Michigan. So adaptation is this manage the unavoidable part. That said, adaptation as a concept is thorny. The idea is complex, it's rather daunting. The first step is often the hardest, and I think for many governments, as well as planners, it still feels rather new and untested. And in order to be effective, adaptation as well needs to be specific to the context. You can't just shop the same solution to every city. It won't work. So this project was kind of conceived recognizing that one of the stumbling blocks to adaptation is perhaps the lack of knowledge and the lack of resources. So our whole project was trying to prepare these kind of knowledge-based, information-based resources to help remove that barrier. There we go. So as I mentioned in the beginning, project done in partnership with NOAA and the Cities Initiative, and I really can't overstate how helpful they were in the course of this project. So it was initially presented to us as a project to provide support for the Cities Initiative cities in doing adaptation, and we refined the goal to these four main objectives. To evaluate adaptation challenges, examine barriers to adaptation, opportunities, but especially best practices. To provide examples, on-the-ground actionable examples of adaptation, and then ultimately to create a municipal-level adaptation toolbox. So Simon mentioned we did this through a set of case studies of adaptation in Great Lakes St. Lawrence cities. We created a set of 7 webinars that were actually presented, and they're available on YouTube right now. We created GIS maps as well as infographics. And all of these materials, I believe, will be on the MARS project's website. But our emails are also at the end of this presentation, and so feel free to shoot us an email, and we will send you our deliverables if you're interested. Though we were focusing on the whole Great Lakes region, these were our partner cities that we did our case studies in, so we got a pretty good representation of cities both in the U.S. and in Canada of different sizes and different locations. So all of our materials are too much to really even overview in 15 minutes, but we've chosen, like I said, a few wider adaptation takeaways to highlight rather than the specific products. So the first of these takeaways is that of fostering what I call an adaptation mindset. I'm probably not the first to use this term or even advocate it, but one thing we came across again and again in our interviews with cities was that they're reporting they wanted to do adaptation, but they lacked the resources. And often that was just staffing resources. People in the cities were already using 110% of their time on day-to-day operations. How could they possibly squish in a whole adaptation planning process? This goes back to the point that adaptation can seem like a big, daunting process, especially when you formalize it into a big adaptation plan. And a formal process can certainly be good, and it's probably the right choice for many cities, but one thing I wanted to highlight is it's not the only way to adapt. And you shouldn't wait for a formal adaptation planning process to begin thinking about adaptation. So that's where this kind of adaptation mindset comes in. So adaptation so far is usually decentralized, and this makes sense. Adaptation lacks any sort of metrics. As a top-down city measure, you can say, all right, everyone across the board, you're going to reduce emissions by 13%, and then people can figure it out. How do you tell units, you're going to be 20% more resilient by 2020? There's kind of no way to achieve that one. And adaptation also lacks easy generalizability. It's a response to a very specific set of circumstances and not even just a very specific location. It's a response to who your populations are, what your government's capable of, you know, the politics of the location as well as your resources. But the idea of mainstreaming in this adaptation mindset is that for many, even just units and departments within cities, perhaps the people in those units will know best what their vulnerabilities already are, more so than maybe an outside adaptation consultant. And so you foster this adaptation mindset, the adaptation awareness, and they'll be able to incorporate adaptation actions into what they already do. Of course, so any sort of adaptation mindset within a community is going to spark from awareness. So these are kind of the base requirements. This could be an awareness of climate impacts. You know, if you've had, here's where I pump our webinars, you know, knowing what the potential impacts are for what your operations are. But if you're perhaps in a political situation where you can't talk about climate change, that could even be just an awareness of extremes. Thinking back to that horrible flood that you had 4 years ago, or the horrible storm. Just kind of knowing what that spectrum is and planning for the ends of the spectrum and having that in the back of your mind as you're formulating plans. And then also, you know, the capacity as a unit to incorporate adaptation into your efforts, to incorporate this thinking for the future into what you're doing. So I wrote the case study for Evanston, Illinois that we did, and I just wanted to give a few examples of how they were able to mainstream adaptation. So Evanston doesn't have a formal adaptation plan, but they've done a lot of sustainability work on mitigation. And I think Evanston was really good at this adaptation mindset thing. And this quote up here is from the assistant director of Evanston Community Services. When I asked her about, you know, climate change and adaptation, she said, for me, it's looking at things that are relevant to who I work with. I love this quote because it's the idea and recognition that climate change is going to make her job different in the future, or perhaps more difficult. But in order to serve her community, she needs to plan for it. So this would, I think, be the first bit, this consider climate change in day-to-day operations. In Evanston, a few examples of this first point are recognizing that more heating and cooling stations will probably be needed. They've also started working with the libraries to get information about those services out to vulnerable populations, as well as having social workers in the libraries. The second bit is your typical adaptation low-hanging fruit idea. Looking for things that probably make sense to do now but will also pay off in the future. Another interesting example from the case study was installing heated intake valves on their water treatment plant. It was in response to a near catastrophic Frazzlice incident they had a few years back, but they also anticipate that it's going to help them in the future with more extreme weather events. And another really interesting thing, this point number three, many people we spoke to in Evanston reported that they were drawing on both formal and informal networks. So this is this don't go it alone. You know, if you're a tree guy in Illinois, you should definitely be talking to other tree guys in Illinois, but you should also want to talk to tree guys in Michigan and have that sharing of best practices. You know, you can learn from what happened in another city. If it was a near catastrophic event and this one thing helped, you want to know what that one thing is and know if it's applicable to your city. And then the fourth is also this utilize existing sustainability efforts. Evanston is lucky in that they have a really robust sustainability framework. They have a climate action plan, which they've been, I believe it's been in existence since 2007. But they will be able to leverage adaptation actions within that existing sustainability plan. So instead of having to do a completely different planning effort, they'll be able to streamline adaptation into that, as well as to pull upon the stakeholders that they used in that previous planning effort to incorporate adaptation. So this is my inspiring adaptation pep talk. You can do it now. It, however, comes with a caveat. So you want to do adaptation, you want to do it well, but you also got to do it smart. For years, the adaptation landscape has seemed to be kind of a let's throw things at the wall and see what sticks, but maybe that's not the best use of your time and resources. So Sam will come up now to talk about targeting your adaptation investments.
Good Morning, everyone. Thanks for sticking around, like Lexi said. I'm going to talk to you about one of the tools that we developed because we don't have time to talk about all the decision tools. And I'll try to draw some broad conclusions based on our studies of all the five cities. So the tool that I'm going to talk to you about is called the Climate Impacts Vulnerability Index. And the tool has its starting point at the understanding that vulnerability varies across cities, and you only have so much money to invest into your infrastructure. So how do you decide where to put your adaptation infrastructure? Well, you can start with big data, which everyone in this room has access to, whether you think you do or not. It's out there, it's free, you can get into it. And so by targeting your investments, you mitigate the risk that you adapt poorly and do the wrong thing, and you increase the benefits of those adaptive techniques that you've carried out. So this tool is really a human-focused tool. It looks at where are the people in our city most vulnerable and use that to decide where to put this infrastructure. It's anchored in GIS technology, and it can be used in the planning phase or the evaluation phase to look back and see, did we do the right thing? Did we put this infrastructure in the right place? What should we do in the future differently in terms of in terms of the geographic placement of our infrastructure? And at its core, it's a decision tool. It's there to help you decide what to do in your city to adapt. So there are four major facets to vulnerability to climate change, and this index puts those together, and for each 100 meter area of your city gives you a score of how vulnerable is that area. And by looking at that over the whole of your city, you can see which neighborhoods are going to be most vulnerable to climate change and direct your adaptation into those neighborhoods so that you get the most bang for your buck. So first is physical vulnerability. And this is where we're going to use satellite images. And so Aster has a really great product that you can download for free, and it'll show you over the past 8 years, over every 100-meter area of the city, what is the average summer temperature. And you'd be surprised how much variation there is. You'll see averages as low as 68 degrees Fahrenheit, 60 degrees Fahrenheit, all the way up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe on a roof. You can also interpolate from weather stations how winter weather varies across the city. Next, you have the built environment and how that creates vulnerability. And this comes from the oldest source of big data, which is the census. So you can look at the age of housing stock, which the census collects. You can look at heating and ventilation types, which the census collects, and understand how much money is it going to cost a family to heat their home or cool their home based on the type of HVAC system that they have in their house. Or maybe they don't have air conditioners. You can track that also. You can also mine your 311 data or your citizen complaint data and see where are people complaining about infrastructure breaking down in the winter. And you can see where is the city vulnerable specifically. Next is personal vulnerability, so individual vulnerability. Market research firms have a lot of great data on this. You can pull out in a census block group, how many people aren't capable of walking a quarter mile? How many people can't lift 50 pounds? How many people can't climb the stairs? And this will tell you if there's some sort of extreme event, a disaster, which neighborhoods do we need to be paying the most attention to? You can also get public health data on asthma, hypertension, things that will make someone vulnerable to more extreme weather, hotter summers, colder winters. Much of this is available for free. There's also a really great database called the Simply Map database that might be worth investing in to get access to this data in readily available forms. And then finally, as we all know, our most poor, our most old, our very young are very vulnerable to climate change. And so based on each city's own understanding of what makes them most vulnerable, you put these together in an index, and you get a map like this that shows you on a 0 to 100 scale where is our city most vulnerable. And you can overlay this map with previous infrastructure that you've put in. You can use this map in a grant proposal process to say, okay, you know, we want 20 green infrastructure things built, and we want neighborhoods that are most vulnerable to climate change to get more access to this money. And if you're interested in how to create this index, you can speak with me later. It's an involved process, and it's customizable, so there isn't sort of a cookie-cutter way of doing it. And that leads me to our lessons learned about cookie-cutter ways, and this is our image taken from space. You do have one here. And that is the problem with prescriptive. So when we started this project, one of our original goals was to create a checklist for cities to say, okay, we've adapted to climate change in this way, what's next? Okay, we can check off. And what we found out is that you can't prescribe solutions for cities. Because climate change is complex and adaptation is complex. But as you all know, cities at their most essential are already a response to a complex problem. And our cities and our city staff can do complex environmental problem solving. So our recommendations are to leverage your existing human resources, your existing programs and frameworks to get climate adaptation done. Secondly, and this is important, I think, is to have a diversified portfolio of both green and classical gray infrastructure. Neither can do the job of adapting to climate change on their own. You must have both to mitigate risk. And finally, don't pigeonhole climate change adaptation. It should not be something that goes to one office or one department or a few staff members. It's something that should be done across many departments so that it's an integrated part of how the city works, and cities can harness all of the disciplines represented in their workforce to have a more resilient city and to adapt to a future climate. So lastly, we just want to thank all these people here who have helped us in this project and all our partner cities, and thank all of you for giving us the time to present our work to you.